Before the show starts, we're going to have a quick word from our sponsor. We've partnered with CoinBeast Media to bring you guys top quality educational Bitcoin content. They have Bitcoiners who are experts in certain areas of Bitcoin called pros who will be presenting on our show over the course of the next couple months. So make sure you guys tune in every single Wednesday to make sure you don't miss them. You can also connect with their pros one-on-one to get a personalized lesson in a certain area of Bitcoin to help walk you through any and all of your questions. They also have wonderfully written articles on their website that are jam-packed full of information, so make sure to check out their website at coinbeast.com. Their vision is very in line with ours, so we're beyond excited to be collaborating with them to bring all of you guys good quality Bitcoin content. So without further ado, let's get into the show.
All right, what's up, class? This is Optimus Fields at My Living Truth, and we're back for another episode. We're at block height 679,260, and the current price of Bitcoin is $62,689. Nick, introduce our guests.
Yo, what's up, everyone? This is Nick here, back with another episode of Bitcoin Kindergarten, and today we have another pro over from our friends at CoinBeast on. We got our boy Tufik, and he's going to be going over taxes on Bitcoin and the clash of cultures around open source. This is something I'm really looking forward to, and I think he's going to be covering a lot of information that is going to be very beneficial to all of you and a lot of stuff that you probably don't know about. So this is going to be a good episode. So Tufik, thank you for coming on. And yeah, we're really excited for this.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me, and excited to be here with Bitcoin Kindergarten. I think it's going to be fun. So yeah, I'll just get into it. I try to be fancy with my presentation name. So I don't know if you feel the intensity, but we're going to talk tax. We're going to talk Bitcoin. Going to talk the clash of cultures around open source, and I'm excited for the last one because we're going to get into a nice little debate. So I guess the presentation is going to come into two parts. I think the first part is just going to be really informative for you guys in the space, and the other one I think also informative, but would love to hear an interesting debate develop around kind of what's been going on in the open source space and know how open source culture is they're trying to reconcile with old legacy systems. All right, so I'm just gonna throw a little bio about myself. So I'm a emerging technology lawyer. I work principally with startups, and even more principal to that in the blockchain space. I started my own firm called Rinno & Co. Essentially, I was in a law firm, and I didn't understand why I had to wear a suit to work 12-hour days. My balls was not happy, and my feet hurt. So I ditched that to start my own law firm. No joke, just because I wanted more comfy pants to wear. And turned out to work out for the better. I've spoken in a number of events on crypto. World CryptoCon to BTC Miami, Bermuda Tech Week. So I should be down in Miami in June. So if you guys are gonna go down there, hope to catch you there. A little bit about CoinBeast. So I got involved in CoinBeast, which is honestly a great place for y'all to get upgraded in your knowledge on crypto. As obviously, there's a lot of good content out there on the internet, and a lot of people make, you know, a lot of the stuff like Bitcoin Kindergarten and whatnot. However, there is kind of the necessity sometimes to access that that high quality kind of type of information that exists with a couple of the professionals in the space, just to upgrade your game in the space. And I think Coinbeast does that. I think what I like about Coinbeast the best is that, you know, its heart is in the right place. You know, we're just trying to get Bitcoin mass adopted. And I think we're all on the same page there. For us to kind of come together and build something as interesting as Coinbeast, it's just, you know, the right thing to do to kind of move the needle forward. And I'm excited to be part of the project. I definitely request you guys all check it out. Check out some of the guys, especially some of our, you know, security and hardware guys are top notch, and I think they can really help you guys out with keeping some of your BTC secure, especially at the prices that we're at now. All right, so I guess let's get the boring stuff out of the way so that we can enjoy the debate first. But I'll keep it pretty pretty light here. I know it's tax season, and you know you're probably going to be turning in your taxes in the United States tomorrow. So it's probably too late right now if you've already filed them. But it's just, I think, good to know from just a really tax standpoint how it works, and then you know, at least from there you can go and. Sorry, someone jumped on. Oh no. Okay, I'll continue going on. I'm just going to turn off my phone here. It's ringing in the background. Sorry about that. All right. All right, let's get going. So Bitcoin is a commodity like gold. So in the eyes of the IRS and the CRA here in Canada, Bitcoin's like gold. And this is kind of like an important thing to consider, is that in a lot of the laws in which are in place currently around Bitcoin, is that they were set up with this theory called the law of the horses, which essentially means if something novel comes up, we're going to use different current legal structures to apply those legal structures to a novel entity through analogies, so to speak. And funny enough, gold is definitely one of them. How's gold is taxed? Well, there's a couple of things that you guys got to keep into consideration. The most important thing I would say two most important things. Thing number one is, at what price did you buy your Bitcoin? And thing number two, if you didn't buy your Bitcoin, how did you acquire your Bitcoin? So I'll give you a couple of examples here. Let's say you run a cupcake shop, and in that cupcake shop, you sold a dozen cupcakes, and you know, you put all the sprinkles. They were dope cupcakes, so they're pretty expensive. You put like saffron on them or some shit, and you sold those cupcakes for a Bitcoin. Let's say that day Bitcoin was at a price at $5,000. That means your corporate income, in that sense, if you're an incorporated cupcake shop, would be $5,000. So that's how you register it in your income as a corporation, which is fine. So I guess everyone got that. Another thing which is important is if you're mining, and you're mining Bitcoin, your Bitcoin is not taxed as corporate income, it's taxed as inventory. So you mine the Bitcoin, similar like you mine gold, and it enters into your inventory, and you sell your Bitcoin. And then from that sales, you have different types of inventory management and inventory taxes around that. If you're an employee and you get paid in Bitcoin, you're going to have to pay income tax on that salary. And on top of which, you're going to have to deduct everything that you need to deduct wherever you live, you know, like pension or whatnot, on that salary as well. And if you dividend out your Bitcoin, you got to pay capital gains on the moment of disposition. So this is the most important part. It's like, what's the price of the disposition? If I got shares in a company, the company wants to pay me $5,000 in dividends and they decide to pay me in Bitcoin, my dividend income is $5,000, so I would pay capital gains on that $5,000. Okay, so did everyone get that part? Yeah. How it's dealt with? Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. Next thing you know is the capital gain. On the capital gain is that the price of Bitcoin at disposition is going to, minus the adjusted cost base, that's the cost in which you needed to acquire the Bitcoin, is going to equal the capital gain. The capital gain is the amount that you're going to actually get taxed on with capital gains tax if things go up or down. Let's go back to the bougie-ass cupcake shop that sold kind of saffron-based child's tears cupcakes. I don't know how I can make a cupcake worth $5,000 when I'm trying here. And let's say you got those cupcakes in March 2020, right? Next thing you know, you sell your Bitcoin today, right, which is trading at around 62K, right? So essentially, the price in which you needed to get the cupcakes plus the price in which you paid, so $5,000, with the adjusted base of how much it costs for you to get that, let's say we keep it simple and we just do it at $5,000, you're going to have an amount that's taxable in capital gains at $57,000. In Canada, where I practice law, 50% of the capital gains is taxable. On the dividends, the same thing. Now you have, if you dividend out $5,000, you're like, you got to pay capital gains on the dividend. You got to go pay capital gains because that was a capital gains on the shares that dividend you out Bitcoin. You'd also have to pay capital gains on the Bitcoin itself. FYI, for the cupcakes, you would also have to pay sales tax on the Bitcoin. So whatever your sales tax is, if you have to register for sales tax, you have to do that as well. So a lot of tax in this whole kind of this cycle. But again, I was bringing back to, what would you rather have, Bitcoin or cash? I think paying capital gains on an accruing asset is better than paying no tax on a devaluing asset. That's just me. A dollar more is a dollar more, am I right? All right, let's continue on. All right. So, what essentially is a good... tax policy, as I talk to the guys, is my marketing manager literally, this is actually pretty funny. I told her, put an image of a guy saying, "Just hodl, bro," and she wrote it. I'm sorry, guys. That was pretty funny, though. So, completely respectable tax advice, which it is. Hodling is definitely completely respectable tax advice. Because if I go back to the other slide to save us from the embarrassment here, essentially, if you just hodl, you never have to pay tax on capital gains because capital gains only happens at disposition of the asset, right? You never sell your Bitcoin, you never have to pay capital gains, and you got that meme with that black guy pointing at his forehead there. For all you memers, that's essentially it. Well, you might say, okay, that's all well and good, but I won't have access to your Bitcoin. Well, guys, loans are non-taxable, right? And I think this is something that everyone really needs to think about, is if you have a serious stash of Bitcoin, it doesn't even need to be multiple, you know, just one really would do. And you want to have access to liquidity, there's a lot of services out there actually give you that access where you can go and collateralize your Bitcoin and get a loan. And with that loan, you can have access to liquidity, which isn't taxed, by the way, right? Loans are non-taxable. On top of which, what's even better is when you're leveraging your Bitcoin in such a way, let's say that that loan goes at an interest rate of 6% or even maybe 10%, let's say. Bitcoin as an asset, it accrues in value, you know, year over year on average of about 20%. So that means you're still coming out net 10% when you're loaning at a 10% interest rate when you have Bitcoin in the bank. So in reality, you get access to liquidity, you reduce your tax, and you still come out with a 10% net year over year if Bitcoin is just on average, right? Some years will do much better than other years we are currently experiencing and hope to experience, you know, the former rather than the latter for many years to come. But it allows you to actually get around this tax on disposition part here, which you can avoid. Corporate income tax, the mining inventory and the salary and stuff like that, that's going to be harder for you to avoid because however you get the money in to your pockets is going to be dependent upon is going to have a different type of tax. And also depending on your current situation, your company's situation, you know, are you eligible for a small business tax credit? You know, are you in a high or low income bracket? And this will take a little bit more creativity here in terms of potentially managing your Bitcoin, so to speak. And it's very case by case, so I can't really bust out any generalities here. But on this one, there's definitely some generalities that can be developed. Last but not least, if you guys are trading a lot on platforms and you're finding it difficult, well, you might say to me, Tafiq, how do I know all this? I'm supposed to keep a ledger or something, no pun intended, and where I can see what price I sold my Bitcoin, what price I bought it, and what happens if I'm trading with other currencies online, like how does that kind of work? Well, there's a lot of great software out there that actually embed themselves in your crypto trading platforms, actually produce, you know, proper IRS documentation for you. So you don't even need to worry about it. They actually just do it all for you. It's pretty crazy. I know the guys at TaxBit who do it, and they're a great company. I think they broke kind of Utah's equity financing round. I think they raised $90 million from the Winklevoss brothers and as well from PayPal Ventures. But really high end piece of software there for any of you guys who are much more into the trading, so to speak. So yeah, any questions on that before we move to other stuff? We got the boring stuff out the way. So anyone got any questions on that?
No, I think we're good.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Cool. Hope I kept it pretty PG there. All right, so let's get into the juicy stuff here. Open source. So open source is essentially software that solves the tragedy of the commons, right? The tragedy of the commons is that when something's free, you're always going to have a complete annihilation of that. Think about the guy who allows for his neighbor's cows to freely graze on his field. All the cows are going to be on his field. But what happens if you have an infinite amount of grass? Well, that's open source for you. But in reality, what is open source? Open source is when you place your source code or application online under a certain particular license. That particular license publishes your code online in a way in which allows it to be used for free by a variety of different people around the world. I'm sure many of you guys are familiar with GitHub. When you're publishing on GitHub, you're going to come down and they're going to say, choose the license in which you want to publish with. And, you know, you may look at it and look at all these acronyms and stuff like that and say, well, you know, what the hell should I do? And it's a tough call. And it's a really tough call because some of these licenses are kind of complicated. Some of them are not, to be frank. MIT license, like two paragraphs. So is Apache. But other ones like GNL is a couple of pages. And it's I even, you know, I'm a lawyer and I read contracts. I know all the time. I find the GNL kind of thick and tough to read. And you may be really confused about, you know, what to publish your license with and what not to do. And really, I can't give you an answer. It really depends on your personal preference and what you're trying to do with your license, which I guess we'll get to talk about a little bit more in the next slide. So here I put types of open source licenses here. For you guys to kind of understand, just in a huge general provision, what does it exactly mean? So we have essentially kind of the MIT and the Apaches, which are the big ones, or the permissive. The permissive is essentially do whatever the hell you want. do whatever the hell you want is that you can do whatever you want with the source code. And you can use it, you can manipulate it, you can say it's your own, except Apache makes you want as an attribution portion to it vis-a-vis MIT. MIT, you have no attribution, right? So you don't have to say who it was for. Here you do. And at MIT, you just have to take the source code as is, limitation of liability. So if you publish a source code under this guy, essentially it means that anyone could do basically whatever they want with it. They could patent it if they want to. It doesn't take away that part from being published under open source, so don't worry. They can manipulate it. They can and they can claim it as their own, except in the Apache case. But it's essentially very, very open source. Here we got the weak copy left, where you get into what's called the lighter GPL and friends, which are essentially just the upgrades. Lighter GPL means is that it's a strict copy left. So what's a strict copy left? What is a copy left? What's a copyright? So a copyright is I write something and affix it to a mean. Right, that means if you put pen to paper, right, that you are creating copyright in the sense that that text in and of itself is protected under intellectual property law. And under here in Canada, the Copyright Act. Copyleft Act means that anything that anyone who uses that source code must publish that source code. Exact source code with the same level of open source provisions as its previous publication. So if I took a lighter GPL license and I built some crap around it and I went to try to sell it, I could sell it, but the only thing I can't sell is that one piece of source code that I might have used for a skin or something, where I would say, well, that was lighter GPL. That's the only one I can't protect. Strong copyleft, which is actually the one that's most used, is the GPL2, is that it also protects not only the actual source code, but what we could call derivative works. So works in which you take the source code, you play around with it, and you do something that is a little bit, you know, a little bit of an upgrade. And that would also protect derivative works as well. So this is a strong copyleft here. Did everyone get this? This is just a good kind of summary. Oops, someone's coming in. I guess not.
Could you help me understand the arrows?
Right. So the arrows are essentially just the way in which kind of the strength of them work. Right. So it's essentially going up and down. And then I think that's what it is. I actually don't really know. I think that's what it is. I like this. I like these guys because it actually just showed them in good little buckets. I'm not too sure what the arrows actually mean.
So essentially, maybe you could put any BSD new type, like permissive code into a weak copy left, and that would be fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I think from the way I understand it is that it comes from the level of strength, right? Because you have in the permissive, you have public, and it goes down this way, and then from here, this can actually fit in here. I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions on this guy? It is a lot of information there, and I could type in what the arrows mean. I just grabbed the one that I felt was the most clear in terms of this kind of structure. So, why open source can screw you sometimes? Well, I think most importantly, let's say if you're developing and you're in a business, if you want to start a company, for instance, and your company is looking to develop some proprietary stuff, that proprietary stuff, if published under open source, isn't proprietary anymore, right? And what happens is that in kind of startups, or at least I would say high tech startups, because, you know, I guess these days, you know, your fancy cupcakes can be a startup. You want to try to build intellectual property in the company, and that intellectual property will reflect the value of the company through a higher share price. Ways you could do that is developing, you know, an application that is novel and unique. It is also by keeping that open source as a trade secret. As a trade secret is a form of copyright protection, where you may have a form of source code, which is kind of the success of your business. You know, take Amazon's one-click buy, and then not want to share it with anybody, because that's essentially what creates the most value for your business. And with open source, you're going to have a tough time patenting your software. And again, patents are ways in which investors like to see value in the company. So I would say traditional investors don't really like open source that much. And you'll have in agreements big sections in which they kind of, for all intents and purposes, shit on open source and make sure that the development that you guys are doing has nothing to do with open source, because they're essentially buying the intellectual, they're buying the technology. At least part of the value of what they're buying is the technology, and they don't want that technology to be given out for free. Why the hell would they pay millions of dollars for it? So on the last one, it makes it less attractive for acquirers. So again, this is again, more in the startup realm here, but less attractive to acquirers. What does that mean? Well, acquisitions are a curious case of the FOMO. People want to buy you just because they're afraid of missing out on you, and you'll see that a lot of big companies buy robust intellectual property, not because they can't build it themselves, but they're just afraid that they're not going to be able to catch you, or they're going to have to compete with you, or they're going to have to try to like potentially not make something as good as you. You know, a great example I always like to use is, you know, Facebook buying WhatsApp. So they bought WhatsApp just out of pure fear, and someone could actually overtake them as being the biggest boss on the internet. And you know, several years later, and they are just at the moment starting to monopolize it. And you'll see this a lot with our clients as well, who have big patent portfolios, right? Other companies who have big patent portfolios are just afraid that their patent clusters and the ways in which they're protecting their intellectual property are not going to be robust enough without this one section of the intellectual property and patent web they don't have and that you have. Therefore, they buy you. So it can really make yourself attractive to investors, a little less attractive to acquirers, when you don't have that robust patent portfolio or IP portfolio, as stated before. But again, I think we all kind of are wide-eyed, as the kitty says here, and we kind of do want to attempt to make changes with our code, and we find that coding is and open source is not necessarily about money or exits or whatnot, but it's really about kind of instilling positive change in society, in our communities. And I think, you know, we go back to no better example than the Bitcoin case study here, which again illustrates the power of open source on so many levels, because an open source allows you to build, you know, an extremely interesting community and have that community build on top of your open source, use your open source, and then create a whole ecosystem which is much larger than maybe, you know, just a simple startup project, to speak. You know, Bitcoin, you know, reached a valuation of $2 trillion faster than any other company that we know of. If it was listed, you know, if we did that type of comparison. And that was because of the robustness of having a huge community all working together for the common cause. It's tough. It's a tough distinction that folks have to make when they're starting off their companies, where, you know, they have to ask themselves, is this going to be proprietary or is this going to be open source? And you got to have to kind of make that distinction. I had a client come in once. He was, a university professor in semantic analysis in AI, and, you know, a brilliant mind, wrote many books on the subject, and one of the things that he wanted to develop was a semantic URL, a URL that you didn't have to actually type in the actual code, would get the sentiment of what you wrote in the URL, and then your website would appear in the browser. Again, an extremely novel and interesting concept, which he's developed through his innovations and inventions. However, you know, we thought long and hard about what to do. You know, do you keep it proprietary, have the ability to raise money through investors, have the ability to then develop this even faster and further, and then be able to actually make the project work, or do you go open source, you know, have maybe a little bit less access to cash, have maybe a broader breadth of access to developers and communities, and actually really change the way we operate. So instead of having, you know, many different browser platforms, we all use HTTP, And similar to what he's trying to do is, next thing you know, we're all going to be just using semantic URLs instead of our current URLs. Another great example again is Satoshi, where Bitcoin was published on the MIT license. Super fascinating. I think Satoshi was able to make this thing happen, but at the same time was able to still enact real change in the world and build a product that has, essentially, better the lives of many, and from what we understand, make a decent buck on the way. How is this clash of cultures solved between the old world of proprietary intellectual property and the new world of open source? Well, I don't really have the answer for you guys there. And I really think it's dependent upon you and what you guys want to do with your code. Also depends on what type of code you have and what it's going to do. The nature of it is also going to change if it's going to be proprietary and or open source. Are you going to be the only developer, or do you need many people developing on it for it to thrive? Do you need outside investment, or do you think this is something that can grow organically and naturally? Do you need to be a CEO and a head of a company? Are you okay being kind of a lead dev, contributing to a foundation, which nourishes and manages the ecosystem? The answer is within all of you guys and what you guys want to do with your projects and your code. And I always like talking this out with folks, so I would really be curious to hear where you guys are coming from and how you guys see it. I probably feel like you guys are going to lean one way than the other, but again, it would be exciting to hear your thoughts. And thanks. That's my presentation.
Awesome, bro. We did get a question in our Discord on the taxes portion, but I don't know. Jessifer, did you want to chime in on the culture wars, or does anyone got some questions they want to ask before I ask the one from the Discord?
Oh, you should hit that Discord one first.
Okay. So, in the Discord...
Keep my screen up here for...
Yeah. All right, so in our Discord, this is referencing the tax portions. He goes, so this is pretty disgusting. What would be a good way to get around all this? I'm in Germany, for example, when you hold your coins for a year, they are tax-free. How can I apply this jurisdiction rules to my coins? Is there a way where I can offer that service to my fellow hodlers? And would I need to own private keys under any circumstances? And one last question. Is it enough to have a paper saying that these coins are in my custody but not owning the private keys? Seriously asking. So there's a few questions in there.
Cool. All right. I guess I'll start with the first question. So... I wish it was that easy, to be quite frank, because once you start transferring money across borders, you actually enter into potential tax situations depending upon the nature of the transfer. The most obvious type of tax that usually happen is what's called a withholding tax, in which the nation in which the money was made withholds a certain amount of money as the money exits the country. Again, I'm a lawyer, so I can't really tell you not to follow the law, but I will tell you that at least here in Canada and the CRA, they're definitely getting slightly better at chain analysis and actually finding out what's going on. They're nowhere close to being great, but or even remotely scary, I think. But they're definitely working on it to kind of bring themselves back up to a level where they can actually start finding out who has coin and who's hiding it. The jurisdictional stuff, I think, just generally speaking, it's you know, it really depends on where you live and where you want to take the money. But again, I would potentially ask myself, you know, where is the money? Where is the Bitcoin being made? How are you making it? Is it abroad? If it's abroad from the United States, do you really need to repatriate it back into the United States? And working through that. But to be quite honest, this is all pretty complex back stuff that I do from time to time. But it's very case by case, because it depends upon, like I said, how the Bitcoin's made, where was it made, where are you in the world, what was your role in making it, through what corporate entity or individual did you make that money, and then going on from there. So, and I don't know if that's a clear answer for you, but I would say if people are too affronted by the level of taxes in which they pay, I would suggest that you speak to someone about it and see if there's a way that you can legally reduce those taxes through the means of the law. Yeah, that's my only thing. And the second question was, you repeat it again?
So I think you just answered, how can I apply those jurisdiction rules to my coins? Is there a way where I can offer that service to my fellow hodlers? And the adjoining question would be, would I need to own private keys under any circumstance? And if he could offer that service.
Offer that service.
I mean, I think you kind of answered it in the previous answer that it might not be possible.
Well, I don't want to say it's not possible. It's definitely possible, but it's complex, and it's very much case by case. You know, you guys can respect that tax law is fairly complex. And even lawyers that practice 100% in tax in their own jurisdictions don't know it with the back of their hand. And you have the variety of different tax regulations and acts around the world, which, you know, I don't know much about at all. And then I know a little bit about the U.S., but that's probably as far as it goes. And then you have the varieties of tax treaties and tax information exchange treaties that you have amongst a variety of different nations that you have to also take into consideration when transferring money. So hyper kind of case by case, so to speak. But I'm happy to, you know, chat it out with folks if and kind of problem solve with them if there's a they think there's an opportunity there.
Awesome. I actually have a question. This is actually a little more like speculative, but in your opinion, do you think that the taxes surrounding Bitcoin will lessen in the future or become more restrictive?
I think they're probably going to stay the same. Unless they change kind of general taxes across the entire board. AKA if they change what's corporate income tax in your country, they change what's capital gains in your country, it's capital gains tax, change what's sales tax. It's Bitcoin is not specifically treated. It's treated as any other commodity, so to speak. So it really, really, I don't think it's going to change. That much, no.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, Andrew, you can jump in or type it in the chat if you want. So we got one more question.
I'll say it.
Oh, there we go.
Cool. Hey, thanks for the presentation. So this past year, I recently started working for a Bitcoin company. So all of my income is in Bitcoin. And this is like obviously very complicated stuff. I'm just wondering if you have maybe a CPA in the state of California that you would recommend.
I do not, but I could talk to my CPA and I could see if I got someone for you there. But it's ahead. Are you an employee of that company?
Technically I'm a contractor.
All right. Okay. So are you an independent contractor or did they still give you a tax slip this year or no?
I'm an independent contractor.
And are you incorporated or are you just a sole prop?
Sole prop.
Right. So this is a situation where it could, so what you got to do is essentially, I would suggest getting a CPA, but you essentially enter into having your personal and business income are meshed into one because they're both you. So that's personal income coming as an independent contractor. So you got to check how much that is when you received it. And it's kind of complicated because if you received a fixed amount of Bitcoin, did you receive a fixed amount of Bitcoin or a fixed amount of cash that was then converted into Bitcoin?
I wish it was a fixed amount of Bitcoin. That would be awesome.
I know. I'm kind of hoping for you.
I'll friend you on LinkedIn. I see your LinkedIn here. I hate paying taxes with a passion. I look at them like they're criminals, and I don't want to give them my money. So anything I can do to pay the least amount possible would be great.
Start a church. No, I'm just kidding. yeah, for sure. Yeah, let's talk online. But there's other folks in the same boat as Andrew there. I would say look, great way to lower your taxes is to increase your adjusted cost base. So that means download an app like Receipt Bank and just take pictures of all your receipts and make sure you collect all your receipts there. Because your receipts increase the cost that you're going to do business, right? If you got a car, calculate your gas, calculate how much you're spending, calculate depreciation on your car. If you got an office at home, realize that your home office there is tax deductible, right? So, calculate how big your home office is, how much you use your internet for your work, that's tax deductible, all that stuff. Anything that you use for work, so to speak, is tax deductible. So that's really one of the best ways to increase that cost base and keep taxes a little lower.
Thank you.
Awesome. Does anyone else
add to that?
Yeah, go, Jim.
As a business owner for 30 years, you have to use their own rules against them as often as possible. That is, to elaborate on what he just said, you write off everything and anything that you can even remotely justify, recognizing that the chances of an audit are super slim if your stuff fits in their boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I don't think I've ever had a personal dinner in my life. it's all business dinners, baby.
Hey, can you, as long as you talk business that night or whatever their stupid rule is,
I always talk
business. If you spend your Bitcoin as Bitcoin, who knows that it's not in your possession anymore? Are they really going to look at your UTXOs on the blockchain and try to make some sense of whether or not you've gained since you bought it in terms of fiat? Because the whole tax thing is based on relative to how much fiat you can exchange it for, because they think in terms of fiat and that this is not money, this is an investment, and you owe them some profits if you make some, which is absurd, of course. But but if you spend it as Bitcoin, how would anybody know?
Yeah, like we get a lot of these questions about how does everybody know, and again, folks do come to me with that. And yeah, and I don't put me in a tough position here, but I am a lawyer, and I can't tell you not to pay your taxes. It is the law, and I do value good tax Samaritanship. But there are ways in which you can, reduce it and pay what is just and fair, what's considered part of the law. And again, if you don't like the law,
I don't like the law, but you're not answering the question at all. How would they know? Do you know how they would know or not know? You don't have to have an opinion on whether it's legal, but how would they know?
Well, if they audited you and they said, do you have Bitcoin? And you said, no, I don't. And then your ex-wife rats you out. You know, you've just misrepresented yourself to the IRS, which is a pretty serious offense.
Would that be hearsay unless you can prove it?
Well, but then they're going to audit you, and then you're down that path.
So that if you have KYC Bitcoin, they're going to be able to see that you obtained it. That's easy, right? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, when they audit you, they're going to ask you to turn in a variety of stuff, right? So I don't know where you hold your Bitcoin, but they may ask for certain access to a variety of your trading platforms. Then in your trading platforms, you can see your transaction history. That's one thing. They may ask for, they are signing now different agreements with trading platforms where they can get certain tax information, not through you, but through them. That's also a possibility. Look, man, like the tax man does not fuck around about their collection of the taxes. Especially the IRS. And if you've ever been audited, I don't wish it on my enemies. It sucks big time. And the reason why it sucks is because they ask you to give everything. Everything and anything. And by the way, the moment you start hiding things, right, is the moment you start committing other serious offenses, which can take you down, another path there, because you're essentially, for lack of a better term, it's obstructing justice. So yeah, I think for you, you just gotta, match your risk reward appetite. If you don't like the taxes, just move to Bermuda. Fuck.
It's right. Not that easy for Americans.
your sovereign citizen status comes into play, whereby you really do have to leave if you can't avoid violence against you by other humans who think you owe them money.
Yeah, well, okay, it very well may be the case. You know, we've had certain situations where we've helped clients offshore and leave Canada and even renounce their citizenship just because the taxes were or such an affront to them. And you know, I think they still love Canada and whatnot, but they just completely don't see eye to eye with the tax policy of their nation of residency. So again, to each everyone's own. Like, everyone has to make these decisions themselves based upon their risk palette, their philosophy, and where they're at in life. But you know, I'm of the very humble opinion, if you don't like something, you should go and try to change it.
That's what we're doing.
Awesome, Tufik. Well, I don't think we have any more questions tonight. Nick, what are you thinking? Is he still in here?
Thank you so much, Tufik, for the presentation. I think we all got a lot out of that.
Hello?
What's up, Nick?
All right, my mic disconnected. But yeah,
such a professional.
Thank you, Tufik, for coming out. That was a very good presentation and very good questions, and I think you handled them well.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Love to be on, and yeah, excited. Reach out to me, guys, on LinkedIn or whatever, and you know, I'm always excited to chat with other Bitcoiners and, you know, talk shop and whatnot, which I guess we're gonna do now. But if you guys want to talk more shop, always game.
Awesome. For the audio listeners, will you just shout out your Twitter or your LinkedIn name, or, you know, where people can reach you and all that good stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I will. So on LinkedIn, it's Tufik Adloni. That's TUFICADLOUNI. There's not many of me, so check me out there. And then on my Twitter is at T, then it's Adloni, so Tad Looney. And that again is ADLOUN, like Nathan, and I.
Awesome. And also check him out on coinbeast.com.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, dude, thanks for coming out. That was awesome. We'll wrap this episode up, but stick around for Teacher's Lounge, and we'll be streaming that right now in a minute. All right, see you later, guys.